Hey there, Dave Robinson here, and you are now listening to an encore episode of Bench Talk, The Week in Science. We'd like to open the show by thanking all of our listeners for their generous contributions to Forward Radio during our fundraising drive that ended last week. Although of this writing, it doesn't look like we're going to meet our goal of $7,000 for this campaign, we did raise enough money that we're going to be able to stay on the air for another 6 months. So that's great. I especially want to thank a few specific friends of Bench Talk for their contributions, like Mary Williams, Rob Weber, Snake Jones, Linda Raymond, Nancy Jakubiak, Fritz Hilton, Amanda Fuller, and Cherise Williams. I hope I didn't forget anyone. And oh, if you would still like to contribute to the station, you can. Just go to forwardradio.org and look for the donate button and give what you can. Thank you. Anyway, we have two good stories on the show today. The first is a historical look at the use of natural products for cosmetics. And the second is an interview with a high school teacher in Mason County, Kentucky, about the innovative educational exercises she uses in the classroom to teach things like hydrology, environmental science, critical thinking, project design, and problem solving. Anyway, let's get going. Dave Robinson here, and I'm welcoming you to another episode of Bench Talk, The Week in Science. We've got a great show for you this week. First, a story I prepared about a 17th century queen of Britain who was described as skinny, hunchbacked, and having buck teeth, but was still considered, quote, quite handsome, unquote. How did she do it? Have you ever wondered about the cosmetics that people might have used on themselves back in the olden days? Have you ever thought about how a society's standards of beauty has changed over the centuries? Well, I just finished reading a research paper published by a Dr. Aaron Griffey, who's an art historian at the University of Auckland in New Zealand, and this article really piqued my interest in this topic. The paper was about Henrietta Maria, a princess born in France in the early 1600s, who ended up becoming the queen consort of King Charles I of the United Kingdom. Now, I'm sure you know about King Charles III, who just acceded to the British throne in September 2022. You know, Prince Charles is now King Charles III. Well, we're talking here about King Charles I, who, with his wife, Henrietta Maria, gave birth to King Charles II back some 400 years ago. Here's some trivia about Henrietta Maria. The U.S. state of Maryland was named in her honor, and one of her daughters went on to give birth to a girl who grew up to be the maternal grandmother of French King Louis XV. Making Henrietta the ancestor of most of today's European royal families. Dr. Griffey published a thorough 26-page analysis of what Queen Consort Henrietta did back in the 1600s to improve her looks, not just cosmetically, but in her iconography and in how she was depicted in portraits that were painted of her. Dr. Griffey's research paper was published in the journal Renaissance Studies in November of 2021. Let's start off with this quote from the article. It's by Henrietta's 11-year-old niece, who described the Queen Consort Henrietta at the age of 33.
The fine portraits of Van Dyck had given me such an ideal of the beauty of all English ladies that I was surprised to find that the queen, so beautiful in her picture, a little woman with long, lean arms, crooked shoulders, and teeth protruding from her mouth like guns from a fort. Still, after careful inspection, I found she had beautiful eyes, a well-shaped nose, and an admirable complexion. She did me the honor to say that she thought me rather like her daughter. So pleased was I that from that time forward I considered her quite handsome.
Now let's take a peek into Ellen Griffey's article to hear what she said about the Queen.
Her beauty was widely celebrated and cultivated. Henrietta Maria's damask skin, redolent of roses and lilies in this period, was accomplished through physic and objects, and promoted and performed in observers' accounts and in portraits. She depended on writers, painters, and physicians to shape her complexion into its ideal smooth, luminous, sanguine state. This article emphasizes that a fresh and blooming face was more than skin deep, but was invested with political, social, and medical import. Her attention to her skin was not the simple vanity of a beauty-obsessed queen. Rather, it was central to the political, dynastic narrative of her elite status and fertility. Deconstructing the Queen's cosmetic practices highlights the contemporary emphasis on natural beauty, and yet a naturalness that was nonetheless forged by an entourage of attendants, distributed in her person and shown through contemporary accounts and paint.
Did you hear that reference to roses and lilies? Well, these two flowers, roses and lilies, apparently embodied France and England at the time. Henrietta was born in France, thus she was a French lily, but married an English king, which made her an English rose. These two flowers end up showing symbolically throughout Henrietta Maria's life. Here's another quote from that article about this.
In literature, lilies and roses represented the ideal facial coloring. The medical properties of the lily and the rose were described by ancient, medieval, and early modern authors, and these flowers were widely used in recipes for the skin.
Well, we all know how much pressure there is on women to look good even now. Well, there was even more pressure on Queen Consort Henrietta Maria back in the 1600s. To quote Dr. Griffey's article once again,
"For women whose social currency typically rested on marriage and children, facial complexion was a powerful mirror of quality and a canvas for enhancing the natural, healthy beauty within. Within the context of elite marriages, the bride's complexion was widely scrutinized because beauty, health, and fertility were all intrinsically connected. It follows that the beauty stakes were exceptionally high for a queen who needed to be the fairest one of all."
There were numerous commissioned paintings of the Queen Consort during her life, and in each one of them, the artist took great pains to depict Henrietta in the best possible light. The colors used for her complexion, the clothes she wore, the background of the painting, the other objects in the painting, they were all carefully selected to win the public's honor, admiration, and respect. And then there's the question of cosmetics. Now, a high-born woman at that time would not want to just brush on pink blush onto her cheeks. That's something only lower-class women would do. Apparently, any woman painting her face like that would be marked as a
pander, bald, or a whore.
High-society women were expected instead to adopt beauty regimes that improved the health of their skin. One recipe, for instance, was
snail water, rose water, lemons, bean flour water, tartar, gum tragacanth, rice, fresh barley, milk, egg whites, and honey. All of these ingredients regularly feature in beautifying recipes, and as a formula, this would have clarified, tightened, and moisturized the skin, but not masked the natural color of the skin.
Beauty experts at the time were also carrying out quite a bit of research on finding new combinations of treatments that would correct for facial discoloration or disfigurement from things like pox, pimples, scars, freckles, roughness, sunburn, rashes, and wrinkles. And believe it or not, two common plant products that were called to task were indeed lilies, they used the roots, and roses, they used the flower petals. They would dry the lily roots and dissolve the extract in rose water. Here's an example from this article that I can give you. Henrietta was only 15 years old when she married, but one time when she was 29 years old, and she had already given birth to two children by then, she got a bad rash on her cheeks. Do you want to hear what was prescribed for this rash? Well, it was called milk of poppy. It was fresh white poppy seeds and melon seeds infused overnight in rose water. Then the soaked seeds were mixed with camphor and mercury, which is terribly toxic, and applied to the rash 2 or 3 times a day. And from the sounds of it, apparently milk of poppy actually worked. Life in the British royal court during Henrietta Maria's time was not just about superficial things, however. Her life was tumultuous. She was unpopular for her French heritage and for her Roman Catholic beliefs. She survived 3 civil wars in England, the dethroning of her husband, the king, and his later restoration to the throne. He was later executed for high treason when she was only 39 years old. She lost 2 of her children to smallpox, and she lived another 20 years after the execution of her husband, the king, but ended up contracting bronchitis, moving back to France, where she died at the age of 59 after taking excess opiates to ease her pain. But let's get back to the topic of Henrietta's cosmetics. Dr. Griffey's curiosity about the culture of beauty during the Renaissance took her to a unique collaboration. It started when she noticed that many ingredients and beauty recipes she gathered from her scholarly studies of the 16th, 17th, and 18th century also appears on the packages of modern beauty products. For instance, rose water is still used in modern skin hydrating mists, and sulfur is still found in some over-the-counter acne creams. So some of these historic approaches to beauty are still in use today, while others are thought to have been forgotten or abandoned, and some were just downright dangerous. And Dr. Griffey saw that there was a real lack of scientific, academically rigorous, lab-based analyses of these old-time cosmetic products. She teamed up with other researchers at the University of Auckland in New Zealand. There's physicists, and there's these two chemists, and there's another historian or two, all working together to investigate the science and history behind the cosmetics that were used hundreds of years ago. They're wondering whether they could discover the chemical compounds in Renaissance cosmetics that might still be useful today. And it's not just for women either. There are also Renaissance recipes for curing baldness and for growing better beards. But the challenge they have is how to distinguish between the useful versus the bizarre versus the dangerous ingredients. There was that mercury that was put into that anti-rash ointment, but there are other century-old beauty treatments that contain bile acids or calf hooves, the heavy metal lead, or the poisonous briony plant. How can they keep these dangerous chemicals out and still have a recipe that works? These researchers realized that to get a better understanding of these different components, they would first have to recreate the original recipes. Thus was born the project called the Beautiful Chemistry Project. So the team started out by looking at beauty treatments that showed up repeatedly in numerous and various historical texts, like rosemary flowers in white wine shows up over and over and over again. There's myrrh powder in egg white, or the velvety covering of newly grown deer antlers mixed in bean flour. The chemists are now carrying out empirical studies to determine the exact volumes and ratios for each of the components of these historic recipes. And this is not easy because the old recipes were often inconsistently written and vague. Another problem is that some of these cosmetic ingredients were kept secret. And since many of the recipes were based on earlier sources, they also had to consult things like ancient Egyptian writings on papyrus and sources from the Roman Empire and the Byzantine and medieval days. So they had to take a very integrated research approach, combining history and science, laboratory and library. For instance, they didn't have access to the same genetic stock of rosemary plants that grew hundreds of years ago, nor the wines that the rosemary leaves were dissolved in. Plus, the descriptions were often short and vague, but they did the best they could. Once the researchers figured out how to make the concoctions that seemed consistent with their historic descriptions, they went about analyzing the resulting mixtures using standard chemistry tools like gas chromatography, mass spectrometry, high-performance liquid chromatography, and ultraviolet spectroscopy. And what are the results? Well, it's still pretty preliminary, but take that rosemary wine tincture, for instance, that I mentioned before. In that, they identified chemical compounds that are indeed still found in today's skincare products, including soothing camphor, eucalyptol, and the fragrant alcohol called linalool. This suggests that the Renaissance tincture of rosemary and wine actually did, quote, make the face fair. It looks like it does that by toning and moisturizing the skin. Myrrh powder and egg whites mixed together are another example. Experiments have suggested that the myrrh draws out the proteins from the egg whites, while the egg whites extract resins, sugars, and volatiles from the myrrh. That results in a serum-like product that has antiseptic and anti-inflammatory properties and probably stimulates collagen growth. One of the chemists says, quote, "It seems like there's a synergy between all of these different ingredients, and this is why it works," unquote. Eventually, the researchers hope to perfect their recreations and bring the products to store shelves, minus, of course, any unsafe ingredients. The collaborators on the beautiful chemistry project think that people will want to go back to something that's natural, and they believe it'll be appealing for people to think they're using products that stem all the way back to the Renaissance. Until then, the beauty for the researchers lies in, quote, "digging the recipes out and understanding them," unquote. So there you have it, the beautiful chemistry project. Historians, physicists, and chemists working together to winnow through aged recipes, looking for information about natural chemicals that could help us look ageless. Thanks to Mary Williams for playing the parts of both Queen Henrietta's niece as well as Dr. Aaron Griffey in that story. Bench Talk team member Rob Weber recently interviewed the winner of the 2022 Outstanding Science Teacher Award from the Central Section of the National Association of Geoscience Teachers. It's Yvonne Garrison at Mason County High School in Kentucky. Let's hear Rob's interview with Ms. Garrison.
If you were a high school student, what would you think of a science class that gives you a chance to get outdoors, doesn't have any tests, and gives you opportunities to work with your classmates using your hands and your brains to solve real-world problems? Sounds pretty good, doesn't it? Well, apparently the National Association of Geoscience Teachers agrees. I've just described a class of Yvonne Garrison, a science teacher at Mason County High School, and she has recently won the National Association of Geoscience Teachers Central Sections Outstanding Earth Science Teacher 2022 Award. We spoke with Yvonne Garrison about some of the projects she's had her students working on.
So we looked at what a watershed was and where the water goes on our campus. I even took them to the wastewater treatment facilities so they could see what happens to, you know, our human wastewater. And then what's just happening to rainwater and runoff on campus. We looked at drains that are everywhere in parking lots that a lot of people don't notice because they're just ubiquitous. And we looked at water flow and where is the water ending up? And it's ending up in our creek down here. We did some water testing and found that the quality of that creek, the biological community, as well as the water chemistry is not awesome there. And so I started asking questions, you know, why is that? You know, why isn't our creek pristine? What is adding to these problems that we are seeing? Where is the water from the parking lot going? And there's actually a pipe that directs it straight to the stream. It doesn't get to infiltrate at all. So we talked about that. And we developed some ideas for solutions. I did a different field trip. This was 2 years ago, where we looked at Green Roof in Lexington, where they had implemented that to kind of manage their stormwater runoff from the roof. They also had permeable concrete, so that allowed some water infiltration from that parking lot of that facility that was actually the Clausen group that we toured. And they also have a rain garden, so students got to see what that was and how that manages water flow, and not only water quantity, but also helping with water quality. So we showed them a lot of we discussed best management practices for watershed uses, lots of things. And then students developed a plan of their own, how we might be able to improve the water management right here at the stream. And there were lots of proposals that the students gave. And I partnered with community members to judge those student projects. And in fact, the student project was introduced by someone at the Kentucky Division of Water. It's even more authentic and more real when I have somebody else, an expert in the field, come in and say, hey, here's the problem. Do you think you can fix it? We'll come back and judge your projects in, you know, 5 weeks or whatever. And so I had people from the Kentucky Division of Water, Conservation District, professors at our local community college here, master gardeners of Mason County, lots of different people who have a stake in it, and to come and judge their projects when we were finished. And the best projects got to actually implement their project. So we gave them the money to introduce the project. And your next question is probably like, where did the money come from? I applied for a grant through TC Energy for like education and environmental improvement. And I asked for $7,000 and they gave it to me. Nice. And so those students, I used some of that money for the field trips. And then the students used that pot of money, whichever projects were deemed best by those community members, they got the money to implement it. And so we did implement those things. We planted like 100 trees to improve the riparian zone of the stream down there. And then we also implemented a rain garden. And I brought in other community members to help us with, like, how do we design a rain garden? How deep do you make it? What are some adjustments that we need to make? What kinds of plants do we put in it? All of that. And that person was a person from SD1 in Northern Kentucky that came and helped us with that. Unfortunately, that was like right before the pandemic hit. So that class, like, it was shut down and that class didn't get to put in the rain garden. But the next year I brought back those students and they led my next year's classes installing it. So we kind of had to work around that a little bit, but we do have a rain garden on campus.
Garrison also told us about the way she favors assessing students based on projects and presentations rather than traditional tests.
I have attended a lot of professional development, and especially since we switched from the Common Core standards to the NGSS standards. Those standards are phenomena-based, but it's really about critical thinking, developing an argument or a solution to whatever problem, phenomena that you are presented with, and then how well can you back up your argument or how good is your solution is basically how it is, and that's how they're assessed now. So after attending a lot of those professional developments, I really started getting away from the traditional test-taking style and went very much into experiments, problem solving, critical thinking, just phenomena-based learning. And that also was what I had dreamed of doing anyway. So when the NGSS standards came out, it really was the green light to go ahead and move forward with phenomena-based learning. And I, as I said in my synopsis, students don't remember content. They remember experiences. And if you've ever, you know, thought back to a job that you've completed or internships that you've held, you probably remember snapshots of doing something or being in the field. Like I remember doing some water sampling in the field. Do I remember what I was testing for? Maybe it was atrazine. I mean, it's hard to remember, but I remember those experiences. And students are the same way. So when I think back to my internships with the EPA, my time at Orsenco, my fellowships and research that I did in college, like that's what I remember. And I know that that's what students are going to remember as well as the experiences. So that's really what inspired me, is just my life experience, knowing that I wanted to give them those phenomena-based and experiment-based and problem-solving experiences. Most of the students enjoy not having a test, and the assessment is your project proposal. That's how we know what you've learned. And I feel like that's an authentic assessment, because rarely in a job will you have to take a test. Like maybe for some training on the job, you might have a few checkpoints, kind of like when you get your driver's license, like a certification type thing. But rarely are you going to have tests after test after test in a job. It's going to be projects. It's going to be collaboration. How well did you work with your team and your group members to get the job done? Did you meet your deadline? And was your project successful? That is all very authentic. And I think that students appreciate that, because you get that question a lot. When are we going to use this? You know, and the answer for taking tests is almost never. So like this year, I didn't give a single test in biology. It was all project-based assessments. So it could be a presentation. It could be presenting your model to the class of whatever concept we were covering. But I think that they really appreciate, well, I've heard a lot of students say, I'm glad that we don't have tests in here. And they appreciate the authentic assessment.
That was our talk with Yvonne Garrison, Mason County High School science teacher and winner of the 2022 Outstanding Earth Science Teacher Award given by the National Association of Geoscience Teachers Central Section. Reporting for the Kentucky Academy of Science, this is Rob Weber.
That was Rob Weber interviewing Yvonne Garrison, the award-winning geoscience teacher at Mason County High School in Maysville, Kentucky. Thanks, Rob, and congratulations, Yvonne. Well, that's our show for the week. You've been listening to Bench Talk the Week in Science. I'm Dave Robinson, and speaking for all the staff at Bench Talk and at Forward Radio, thanks for your support, and see you next week.